Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way this hour, Illinois will play a pivotal role in control of the U.S. House. Democrats are about to redraw congressional boundaries. This is one state where they believe they can add to their advantage. We'll discuss that. Also, police are usually called when someone is having a mental health episode. The result is dangerous for both officers and the person involved. But Chicago is about to try a different approach.
We're really moving towards a model that really aspires to have residents in those circumstances met by healthcare professionals, specifically mental health professionals who have the training that's needed in order to resolve the residents' concerns.
We'll hear from those behind a new law requiring the teaching of Asian American history in schools, and also learn how the pandemic has been especially hard on students who need special education. Those stories and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, Chicago will try a new approach when someone is having a mental health crisis. Instead of relying on the police to handle the situation, we'll hear a report. We'll also find out about a new farmer-led co-op designed to help small producers. And Asian American history will be a required part of teaching in Illinois. We'll hear from supporters about what that will include. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. Well, a new type of political blood sport is about to get underway at the State House. It could dictate who controls Congress. Democratic leaders will soon begin carving up Illinois into new congressional districts based on census data. The state's delegation to Washington could turn decidedly more Democratic and influence Nancy Pelosi's political future. Reporter Dave McKinney talked about the political maneuvering with one of the nation's redistricting experts, David Wasserman, with the nonpartisan Cook Political Report with Amy Walter.
Can you tell us how Illinois fits into the national picture and how it could influence whether Nancy Pelosi remains Speaker?
Illinois is absolutely pivotal in the race for House control. Keep in mind that Democrats have virtually no margin for error. They're sitting on a 5-seat majority, and Republicans could conceivably pick up 10 seats from redistricting in the states that they control. Democrats have to counteract that somehow, considering that neither the Supreme Court nor Congress have stepped in to curb the practice of gerrymandering. And that means that their mission really falls to two big states that they control, Illinois and New York. Now, Democrats are already at a 13-5 advantage in Illinois, but they're looking to extend that to as much as 14-3. And the irony is that the two Republicans at the greatest risk of seeing their districts eliminated or at least made unwinnable are the two Republicans in the delegation that Democrats like the most, Adam Kinzinger and Rodney Davis.
Do you see any sort of particular shakeups in the boundaries that are drawn in Chicago and the collar counties?
I do. And the number one priority for Democrats in Chicagoland is to shore up Lauren Underwood, who only won re-election by a razor-thin margin in 2020. Currently, her district only voted for Biden by 2 or 3 points. We're looking at potentially that district after the redraw voting for Biden by 15 points.
Those numbers that were released last week showed an increase in Hispanic and Latino population statewide. The white population seemed to drop a little bit, and I think the black population was static. Do you think that we're going to see any kind of increase in representation for particularly Latinos?
Yeah, at the state legislative level, absolutely. At the congressional level, it's a more complicated picture. Although we did see a huge increase in the Hispanic share of the population in Chicago in the last decade, it's unclear that there are enough Hispanic citizens of voting age to support two majority Hispanic districts. And it's unclear that Congressman Chuy Garcia, who currently represents the infamous Earmuff district, the fourth district which connects Hispanic neighborhoods on the north and south sides, would support such a plan to disconnect the earmuffs into two separate Hispanic districts in which Hispanics would still be a bit shy of 50% citizens of voting age. But it is going to be a source of debate in the coming months.
I mean, it wasn't that long ago. I mean, that Republicans held the governor's mansion in Illinois, and it felt as if they had some political presence here. you know, this is the third straight decade now that Democrats have controlled the map-making process. I mean, what is it going to take for Illinois Republicans to ever be a force again, given the way they just keep losing on redistricting?
Well, this is why redistricting is so pernicious overall in America to governing, is that it allows the majority to steamroll the minority. The most predictable net outcome of this redistricting cycle nationwide is we're going to see much more polarization. Blue states are going to send even bluer delegations to Washington. Red states are going to send even redder delegations to Washington.
That's David Wasserman with the nonpartisan Cook Political Report with Amy Walter. He discussed redistricting and what might lie ahead in Illinois and Congress. He spoke with Dave McKinney. Well, a longtime fixture in state and national politics is mounting a challenge to Congressman Rodney Davis in Illinois' 13th District. As Hannah Meisel reports, Democrats see taking out Davis as key to keeping their majority in the U.S. House.
Nikki Bidzinski most recently led the Federal Office of Management and Budget under President Joe Biden, but returned to Central Illinois earlier this summer to launch her campaign. She says she's running because
in Illinois, the middle class is slipping away, and Rodney Davis isn't doing enough to protect Illinois' working families.
Bidzinski has long worked in state and national politics and was a senior advisor in Governor J.B. Pritzker's campaign and during his first year in office. Congressman Davis has had a challenger in each of his last five elections. He barely won his first cycle in 2012, and the contest was so close in 2018, CNN mistakenly called the race for his opponent. The Republican is weighing a run for governor if Democrats redraw his 13th district so he can't win. I'm Hannah Meisel.
The real estate market continues to be red hot in Illinois. The Illinois Realtors Association says homes sold twice as fast in July than in the same period a year ago. That also drove prices higher. The group says homes sold in an average of 24 days last month compared to 50 days in July of 2020. The median sales price also jumped more than 12.5% in that period. A main reason is the tight inventory of homes on the market. There were 30% fewer up for sale compared to a year ago. And while it's been a seller's market, home sales are expected to cool off later this year. Experts say the number of potential buyers is on the decline. Well, every year, Chicago's 911 operators receive tens of thousands of mental health crisis calls. And to respond, Chicago relies almost entirely on the police. That's the same in most other communities. But Chicago officials say starting next week, that's going to change. Chip Mitchell tells us more.
2 weeks ago, Elias Roman and his wife were chatting with friends in front of their house in Chicago's Little Village neighborhood.
Just enjoying the weather, when I seen three squad cars, they came flying. They came back to back with their lights on.
The police stopped in the middle of the block. Roman is an anti-violence worker and has a police scanner he uses for his job. He pulled it out to hear what was going on.
Not sure which yard he jumped.
I heard one of the officers tell dispatch that the mother had said that the son has threatened her with a gun and saying that he had a gun.
They were neighbors a few doors down in a one-story house. The dispatcher called for all available units in the area. Roman says they did not take long.
I see like around 10 police cars come from both sides, surrounded the whole block. And then I seen like a SWAT tank come down the middle of the block too. And they came, SWAT came like with shields, big rifles.
Now, Roman says he knew this family. The son's 20 and grew up tagging along with Roman's old gang. The young man also has a mental health condition.
I knew that he's bipolar. He has told us before, his mom told us before, he takes medication for bipolar.
Now the mother was outside saying her son had gone off his meds and locked himself in the basement. Roman says he could see the young man peeking through a front window of that basement, just a few feet from the street where the police had amassed. Roman says he doubted there were any guns inside.
It's because I know him. I've been knowing him since he was a little kid, and he never seemed the guy to carry some guns, man.
But the police took the threat seriously.
Seeing all these cops out here, man, I was a bit like nervous. Like, man, I don't want nothing to happen to this guy or him getting shot.
The standoff lasted for hours. Roman is not a mental health professional, but the officers finally allowed him to go and try to talk the young man out.
Like, man, I see you got a crowd out here waiting for you. I told them, playing around. And then he's like, yeah, man, like, they want to get me. I'm like, man, they don't want to get to. It's just everybody's concerned because you had said there's guns. Like, come on, man, like, don't do that to yourself or your family because, you know, by any chance anything can go bad. Come on, bro, like, think about your safety. That's what I was telling them.
It worked. The young man came out. An ambulance took him to the hospital. If not for Roman, if not for a neighbor who knew the 20-year-old and was willing to step into a volatile situation, the young man could have ended up in jail, hurt, even killed. Those things have happened in Chicago when police have responded to mental health crises, but officials say they're making changes. Matt Richards is a Department of Public Health deputy commissioner. He outlined some of the plans to a community advisory panel this month.
We're really moving towards a model that really aspires to have residents in those circumstances met by healthcare professionals, specifically mental health professionals who have the training that's needed in order to resolve the residents' concerns.
Starting Monday, officials say new crisis response teams will handle calls in two areas, one on the south side, the other on the north side. The teams will consist of a paramedic, a mental health professional, and a police officer trained in crisis response. For advocates, it's a step in the right direction, but some are concerned because the police will still have a role.
The mere presence of police officers can trigger full-out crisis.
Arturo Carrillo is the Brighton Park Neighborhood Council's Director of Health and Violence Prevention.
And once police are on the scene, the temptation for police backup is too great. And before you know it, you can have SWAT teams showing up to a situation that could have de-escalated without the presence of a police officer.
Carrillo says the police involvement could also make people hesitant to call for help in the first place. University of Chicago health policy expert Harold Pollack agrees that introducing police into a mental health crisis raises the stakes, but he says it's not an easy call.
So imagine you have a 911 call. Someone calls because her adult son is having a mental health crisis. We really don't want to see a law enforcement response to that. We're not trying to criminalize that person. But it's also the fact that he's punched his mom before, and she's been hurt, you know, and she's a 60-year-old woman, and he's a 28-year-old man. Do we send a police officer to that call? It's not an obvious answer to that. It may be what we do is we send a police officer to that call, but he's not the person who's interacting directly with that gentleman. You have someone else interacting with that gentleman, and the police officer is available in case there's a need to keep people safe, but is not directly in the face of this person triggering and escalating that situation.
That setup, when police and mental health professionals arrive together, is known as a co-responder model. In coming months, the city says it'll also try out two other models for crisis response. Those will not include cops. University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee social work professor Amy Watson says the city should invest in those non-police teams.
My concern is if we only go to co-responder models is that we'll stop there. And that the only option for mental health crisis response will always involve a police officer.
Watson has studied Chicago's crisis response for years. She says there are safe ways to have non-police professionals respond to 911 calls, even in high-crime neighborhoods.
We have other professionals that go into those communities to do their jobs, and they're doing it every day. We have visiting nurses, community health workers, violence interrupters, and we can learn from them how to do it safely.
Watson says cities like Chicago often lean too much on police to handle mental health crises. She says these pilot programs could be the start of a new approach. Chip Mitchell, WBEZ News.
You may be familiar with the fable, The Boy Who Cried Wolf. Social media has allowed us to witness certain women displaying this type of behavior in malls, parks, and other public places across America. Yvonne Booz takes a closer look.
The term crying Karens describes the actions displayed by some white women who play the victim when encountering someone of a different race. They claim that person is trying to harm them in one way or another. They sometimes seek backup from a store manager or other authority figures. Suzanne Dex White is a professor and chair in the Department of Counseling and Counselor Education at Northern Illinois University. She says these performances have been playing out in America for some time, but the internet has given them a wider view.
So it's new in some ways because social media brings things into our consciousness that maybe we hadn't seen before. But this using our oppressed status to oppress others is something that sadly has been going on for far too long.
One notable instance that had tragic consequences took place in 1955 Carolyn Bryant accused 14-year-old Emmett Till of making physical advances towards her. Bryant was white and Till was black. He was lynched after this accusation. Years later, she admitted to author Timothy Tyson that she had lied about the details of the encounter. A more recent and less deadly occurrence of the behavior took place in New York City when Amy Cooper, another white woman, called the police on Christian Cooper, a black man who was bird watching in Central Park. Dax White says, "We saw this conduct more in the past couple of years because of the spotlight that is shining on equality in America."
The crying Karens, there have always been folks who want to use their privilege to oppress others, even by using their privilege to show how they are victims themselves. So yes, it's a way of responding to society, cultural events.
She says this way of thinking leads those who feel oppressed or a loss of power to find others to put down so that they can feel better about who they are.
We have to remember that this kind of behavior, all behavior like that is learned. Racism is learned. The hysterical reactions, I cried once, I got what I wanted, I'm going to do it again. So it's this idea of reward for this behavior.
She says the women who falsely claim that they are being mistreated can change the way people respond to those who are being victimized. Dags White suggests that those who are close to these women who cry wolf should help disengage their actions by having honest conversations with them without accusing them of doing something wrong.
Say, hey, calm down, take a breath, step back a minute, let's talk about what happened. And we need to have curiosity. And tell me where these tears are coming from. Tell me what's going on for you. I want to understand what's happened so we can figure out a way to help you get what you need.
She says this behavior will continue until a societal shift takes place where everyone realizes that we are all human beings regardless of race. She says this change of gears won't happen until individuals learn to focus on what brings us together instead of what separates us. And she explains that this realization will only come through education. I'm Yvonne Booz.
The fight over masks and vaccines is dividing many communities. We'll hear more. That's next. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. By now, you've probably seen videos of school boards facing angry parents over the issue of requiring face masks for students. Unlike Illinois, Indiana state officials are offering guidance but no requirements on masking up in schools. They're leaving that decision up to local school leaders. Farah Yousri reports on how the issue is turning people against each other.
New Albany is a small southern Indiana city with a close-knit community. Elaine Murphy is the president of the school board of New Albany Floyd County School District. She says school board meetings here are normally pretty low-key, but nothing prepared Murphy for the last meeting.
The public comment portion of the meeting is over at this point. We were
188 people crowded the hall, according to Murphy. They called her a liar, among other names.
It's sad to say that, you know, now when I see someone come in with a flag and a flagpole, I'm thinking, well, that's a potential weapon. I've seen that before.
Crowds, even from out of state, were at this local school board meeting to protest masks. But days later, the Floyd County School District required masks based on the local infection rate. In Indiana, Governor Eric Holcomb says he supports school districts that require masks, but the decision is ultimately up to local school board members like Murphy. Now she's on the front line of what is a health crisis at its core.
This is Hazel, my oldest granddaughter.
Family pictures line Murphy's house in New Albany. She's in her 60s and has dedicated her whole life to her own children and to serve New Albany's school kids, first as a special education teacher, then a principal. When she decided to run for school board, politics and ideology were not on her mind.
At this point, there are people that don't trust elected officials. They just don't. And I think as a someone who's been elected, I have to continually work on, yes, I am trustworthy.
The school was once her safe haven, but now leaves Murphy and her family worried about her safety. Now, Murphy keeps a baseball bat next to the door. I asked Murphy if she'd want to tell the parents one thing. What would it be? She said, ask them, how can we work together? And where's the middle ground? Here's one response.
You send your kid with a mask, I'll send mine without one. I think that is the middle ground.
That's Heather, one of the most vocal parents at that school board meeting. She lives a few miles away from Murphy. She has a 2-year-old boy and a 9-year-old girl who goes to one of the county's schools. She asked me not to use her last name because she fears for her job and her children's safety. Her daughter had an eye surgery when she was 4. Now she needs glasses to protect her eyes from turning in. Wearing a mask with her glasses fogging up and her face sweating was a real challenge last year.
So I took her back to the ophthalmologist over the summer and she's like, Heather, you have got to keep her glasses on her face or she's going to have surgery again.
And it plays like the doorbell and then like,
hello.
It's got Peppa. So
Heather says the mask decision isn't about politics for her, but not far from the Peppa Pig figurines, she shows me some printouts of Trump-era talking points.
So I like to have like all my research and stuff here.
There's also her own research into COVID.
I don't trust any government health authority anymore.
Heather is reading an influx of small-scope studies from all over the world, mostly peer-reviewed and published in reputable journals, and some aren't, and they may offer different guidance on whether children should wear masks. But the current CDC guidance is clear. Kids should wear masks in schools because data shows masks limit the spread of the virus. Heather disagrees, and she's not shy to express her mistrust at some school board meetings. But this comes at a price.
There are parents that are already actively trying to get some of us fired. They're actively targeting us as parents.
It's unclear if the next board meeting of the new Albany-Floyd County schools will attract an angry crowd. But it seems that leaving pandemic decisions in the hands of local boards faced by confused and concerned parents is testing this small community's limits. I'm Farah Yusri.
For more than a month, the number of patients in central Illinois hospitalized with COVID-19 has been steadily rising once again. Christine Herman spoke with a critical care doctor, Vishesh Paul, to discuss what he's been seeing at Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana.
I was looking at some of the State Department of Public Health data, and I noticed that in parts of southern Illinois, ICU capacity is getting to like pretty alarmingly low rates, like below 10%. And I know in Region 6, which includes Champaign County and many surrounding counties, we haven't reached that dire of a point yet. But what does it look like on the ground?
The ICU is nearly full, and just the turnover is also so much. And our census is full. We are opening up additional surge unit also. We have opened up another intermediate / ICU unit on another floor to take sick patients. And we are constantly getting calls from our partner hospitals to take in patients, and we have been trying to help them as much as we can.
Earlier in the pandemic, when there was a big rise in hospitalizations, I talked with someone about just the calls to transfer patients were coming from further and further away. Is that the same thing happening? You're getting calls from places maybe even beyond the service area, even neighboring states?
Absolutely. Yes, we are seeing that trend come back again. We are getting patients from far, like Southwest, near St. Louis, even from far off in Indiana. Yes, as we are the level one trauma center, we get calls for that, plus also for COVID patients.
Is there anything different you're noticing about COVID patients now versus in previous waves? Can you talk about like vaccinated versus unvaccinated, or any other demographics in terms of age? Are you seeing younger people now? How is this current wave of hospitalizations different from the previous ones?
We have a teenager also in the pediatric unit. So it's teenage to adult range, but I would definitely say this time we are seeing the mean is a little younger than what we saw earlier. And I think more than 80% patients that are getting admitted are unvaccinated. We are seeing breakthrough cases in vaccinated also, but more than 90%, I would say, are mild cases, just with cold symptoms or requiring a little oxygen, and they recover fast. It's the patients who are unvaccinated, who have other medical conditions also like diabetes and obesity, they are the sickest. And it just feels bad to see them going down rapidly.
I see nationally it's about 95% of people ending up hospitalized with COVID are unvaccinated now. What is that like for you and for other healthcare providers to be still dealing with this far into the pandemic? Because I know when the vaccine was rolling out, there was a lot of hope that we're going to get protected and we're going to move past this. The light's at the end of the tunnel. What has it been like emotionally to live through all of this?
It gets frustrating. I can see the frustration that despite the vaccine availability, there are a lot of people who are not taking it. And unfortunately, like when we see them in the hospital, there are quite a few who have actually told me, I wish I had taken this if I knew it was going to be like this. Our teams are working hard. They are working tirelessly. Day in, day out, there are COVID patients coming. We are always saying as a community, we need to take action to get vaccinated.
Is it frustrating for you to go out in the community and I guess be aware that 50% of the people in our area are not vaccinated despite the vaccine being available to anyone 12 and older? People aren't wearing masks in the stores even weeks after the CDC changed that guidance. I've noticed that myself. What is it like for you as a healthcare provider to see that sort of thing happening in your own community?
From the place I'm coming from and where my colleagues are, and as a medical provider, yes, it is frustrating. We have vaccine available. We are not in shortage. COVID is a serious disease, and this is a preventable problem. And we are urging everybody to get vaccinated, so hopefully we can control this pandemic in the near future.
That's the Carle Foundation Hospital critical care doctor and pulmonologist, Dr. Vishesh Paul, speaking with Christine Herman. The Midwest is known for agriculture, corn, wheat, soybeans, but lavender? Maybe not so much. Rachel Schnelly with Harvest Public Media has the story of one couple who decided to give it a try.
Katie Lockwood and her husband both worked for the IT department for the UM System Colleges, but were also hobby farmers for 20 years. So when they moved to Centralia in 2011 and had a small plot of land beside their house, they weren't sure what to do. For Katie, it was simple. She'd always wanted to try and grow lavender, but as they quickly realized, it was a different kind of crop than they were used to.
Here in Missouri, it is rather difficult to grow lavender, so we did a lot of research before we planted our first plant, worked very closely with MU Extension because they do soil analysis and make recommendations around how you can improve your pH levels and texture and so on to make it more suitable for growing lavender.
They also got help from people outside the state as they realized lavender is not a native Missouri crop. Kelly McGowan is a field specialist in horticulture for MU Extension. She says she knows the Lockwoods, but realized there wasn't a lot of data about what it looked like to successfully grow the crop in Missouri, which is very different from the plant's Mediterranean origins. She says in a lot of ways, Missouri couldn't be more different. Instead of arid, dry climate, Missouri is wet, muggy, and sometimes has harsh winters. She started a series of small lavender farms across the state. Through this and conversations with people like the Lockwoods, they hope to figure out how to make the crop viable for small farmers.
Diversifying, growing lots of different things is sometimes helpful. And, including lavender in that is really my goal. I want people to not be afraid of growing it. You can make pretty good money off of it. You know, it isn't cheap to go to a lavender farm and pick lavender or buy products or essential oils. So I just want to see our farmers be successful with it.
McGowan says the great thing about lavender is the variety both in products, from coffee to cocktails to essential oils and soaps to the crop itself. At first glance, all the Lockwoods rows of lavenders look exactly the same. But as you get closer, you realize there are differences in colors. And while there are 14 varieties at the farm, there are more than 450 in the world.
There's actually more than that, but those are the ones that have names. So we actually don't grow from seed because lavender cross-pollinates really easily, and it's hard to get the true strain. You're not necessarily going to get the same plant with the same scent or the same oil content or the same color and so on.
Katie's idea for a lavender farm began in 2016, and the first planting was in 2018. They plan to open a U-pick season for customers in 2020, but because of the COVID-19 pandemic, this is the first year they've offered it. They began this year's season at the beginning of April and are open daily from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. as well as 10 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. on Fridays. Surrounded by fields of lavender with bees buzzing and birds chirping, Katie and her husband welcome people to the lavender farm. And they say bringing people to rural Missouri was one of the reasons they started this business in the first place.
We felt like it was a good choice for us and would be fun to bring to the community, a fun thing to bring people out to an area maybe of Missouri that people don't tend to visit very often. They could learn more about the battlefield nearby and see some of the historical places even in town and just introduce people to an area they might not normally come.
While their U-Pick season ends with the summer, Katie said their business doesn't stop there. They plan to be at the Columbia Farmers Market and to sell their lavender merchandise all year long.
For Harvest Public Media, I'm Rachel Schnelli.
A new study shows each year that feral hogs are responsible for as much carbon put into the atmosphere as a million cars. Chris O'Brien is the lead author of a study in the journal Global Change Biology. He says in the U.S. alone, the animals dig up an area the size of Puerto Rico, releasing carbon into the air.
Wild pigs are an incredibly multi-threat species, more or less. You know, they impact agriculture, biodiversity. Our new study shows that they can impact soil carbon emissions.
States including Illinois and Missouri have long dealt with feral hogs as they multiply quickly and don't have any natural predators. O'Brien says the carbon footprint of wild pigs will likely increase in the coming years. Here in Illinois, there are many produce growers selling their fruits and vegetables at farmers markets and to local restaurants. But those small farms are having a hard time scaling up due to a lack of processing facilities or places that can prepare food to be sold in bulk. A new farmer-led cooperative is hoping to change that. Dana Cronin spoke with Jeff Hake. He's a Central Illinois farmer helping to spearhead the Farm-Fed Co-op.
Over the past 10 years, there has been a growth in the number of small farms that are growing fresh produce and, you know, direct-to-consumer products and things like that in Central Illinois. The ones you see at farmers markets, you see showing up more and more at grocery stores and things. The trouble that they have is that there's a cap on their growth, at which it's harder for them to reach larger markets without making really huge investments. And usually tapping into that kind of investment capital is just not really feasible. And it just is out of reach for most of those farmers. So there's a cap on growth for them. At the same time, there are a lot of buyers in our area who would love to have access to really healthy, nutritious local produce. But because of economies of scale, because of pricing, because of regulatory restrictions, they cannot effectively buy produce from local farms. So even though that food is close by, they have to buy food from much farther away, and it might be lower quality. Our hope is that the cooperative that we're proposing and the facility that it would operate would help fill that gap.
So what exactly is the Farm-Fed Cooperative, and how exactly will it address that problem?
Yeah, the facility that the cooperative would operate is in itself not a novel idea. What we're proposing is a facility that could buy in fresh produce from local farmers on a quite large scale. So we're talking about many hundreds or thousands of pounds of fresh produce at a time, get it processed all at once, freeze it, and then make it available in larger quantities to institutional buyers in our area or larger retailers like grocery stores in Central Illinois. That kind of infrastructure, that kind of processing facility, things like it once existed in Central Illinois, but they left a long time ago, decades ago. And now we have a resurgence in our local food economy and our local food system. And it's time for the need to be met for the kind of processing that we're trying to create with this facility.
I think a lot of people, upon hearing about this project, might be surprised that this doesn't already exist, right?
It seems like such an obvious thing. And there have been attempts at this kind of thing in Central Illinois before, but more than that, the amount of times you hear about this need existing here, it's constant knowing that there's a need for this. And yet it's for a whole variety of reasons having to do with policy and economics for decades, these things have struggled to exist here or have left at some point. And yeah, it might be surprising for people to learn that, you know, this is one of the richest agricultural regions in the entire world. And yet we're not really focused at all on growing fresh food. And that's something that seems like a huge oversight and a huge opportunity because it's missing here currently.
That's Dana Cronin speaking with Central Illinois farmer Jeff Hake, part of the newly formed Farm-Fed Co-op. There's more information on their Facebook page. While we have more of statewide ahead, we'll learn about a new requirement for teaching Asian American history in Illinois schools. That and more still to come on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford, and still ahead, the impact of the pandemic on special education students. That story is coming up. Well, this summer, Illinois became the first state in the nation to require the teaching of Asian American history in schools. Reporter Maureen McKinney looked at what will be taught starting next school year and what it means for people of Asian descent.
Mary Gabrielle Manching was one of a few Asian students at the Chicago High School where she recently graduated.
Not even seeing that many people in my student body that I could relate to or I could share my culture experiences in of itself already felt discouraging and alienating.
And then there were the microaggressions, like the kids telling her traditional Filipino lunch was weird, or assuming that she would always perform well academically just because she was Asian American. She remembers not hearing a word about Filipino history until there was a short paragraph in her high school world history book about how President William McKinley decided to colonize the Philippines because it was America's manifest destiny. With Governor J.B. Pritzker's signature on a new law, starting with the 2022-2023 school year, all public elementary and high schools will be required to offer a unit of study on Asian American history in the state, Midwest, and country. That includes contributions of Asian Americans advancing civil rights and achieving in several areas such as the arts, humanities, and sciences. Grace Pai is the executive director of the Chicago branch of Asian Americans Advancing Justice.
It is particularly urgent for our public schools to teach Asian American history now because of the stark rise in anti-Asian racism and xenophobia that we've seen.
Anti-Asian racism and xenophobia, she said, existed long before the COVID-19 pandemic.
Political rhetoric, scapegoating, really, I think, accelerated and intensified violence against our community.
In March, six Asian women were murdered in Atlanta spa shootings that killed eight people, and the group Stop Asian Pacific Islander Hate released a report that tracked more than 9,000 hate incidents in 2020 and so far in 2021 that included verbal harassment, physical assault, and civil rights violations. The teaching of history can dispel harmful stereotypes, said State Representative Jennifer Gong Gershowitz, a Glenview Democrat and third-generation Chinese-American who sponsored the law. She said, at its core, the law is about teaching empathy.
And it's about ensuring that Asian American stories are uplifted at a time of rising anti-Asian hate and violence. The root cause of discrimination is ignorance.
She said, education is the best tool to fight ignorance.
Learning about Asian American history has certainly helped me gain a deeper understanding of who I am and where I fit in the larger context of American history. And I knew nothing about Asian American history until law school when I studied the constitutionality of race-based immigration laws. I didn't know that the Chinese Exclusion Act existed.
Her grandparents came to the United States in the 1920s and faced discrimination and deportation under the Chinese Exclusion Act, which banned Chinese immigrants and was enacted in 1882. For over a decade, her grandparents lived in fear, she said, not knowing whether there would ultimately be a path to citizenship. For Gong Gershowitz, it was eye-opening and also painful.
It was earth-shattering for me to learn the truth about my family's experience. I had been told the fairy tale version.
Kristen Kazmarek is a history teacher at Hillcrest High School in the south suburbs of Chicago. She said it was a travesty that it took an act of law to compel the teaching of Asian American history.
Far too often, I feel that certain histories are often lost in the mix of things, and it's important that we continue to tell those stories and keep them alive.
I'm Maureen McKinney.
And now we tell you about a special ceremony. More than 40 people looking to get out of a life of gun violence recently celebrated getting their high school diploma. They're part of a program called Chicago CRED. It offers counseling and training to those at the center of the city's gun violence epidemic. The goal is to put them on a new path and reduce their risk of shooting or being shot. And graduating from high school is a major milestone on that journey. Patrick Smith tells us more.
There was a day in 2011 when Lorenzo Taylor was outside his house. He was trying to help some friends who had locked their keys in the car when someone came out of an alley and started shooting. A bullet hit Taylor's cousin in the back and killed him. Taylor was just 17 at the time. Violence was not completely new to him. He was already in a gang, but this was the first person from their crew to be killed. And after witnessing a murder up close, there was only one response for him and his friends. Hypervigilance.
We literally didn't go in the house after that. We was on the block every day because we just had to protect everything around us. Like, now it's like, ain't no losing no more people. Now you got to protect everything that's on this block, which is each other.
Taylor dropped out of school as he tried to stay alive. The gang and the escalating violence became his life. He spent the next decade locked in it.
Because it's easy to say, yeah, just stop, but stop and then do what? We can't move. So what are we supposed to stay in the house forever?
Taylor's lifelong best friend, Dantrell Jelks, was in the middle of it with him since they were little.
I was in the street since I was like 8 years old, chasing up behind my brothers, being a lookout man for the police, like all this when I was a kid.
Years ago, Jelks was shot several times. Many of his friends murdered. In 2019, he was released from prison after being convicted of being a gang member in possession of a machine gun. Then, last October, Taylor got shot while he was walking to the store. Taylor and Jelks knew how to respond. Revenge. But the shooting had caught the attention of anti-violence workers with Chicago CRED. They knew it was part of an ongoing conflict and worried about retaliation. The outreach workers got Taylor's number from someone in the neighborhood. They got a hold of him and were able to talk him and Jelks down. They were ready for a change.
We weren't, like, active when I got shot, but that almost made us jump back into a lifestyle.
It was a moment, but at the same time, we all lose at the end. We go get back together, and one of us risks going to jail or getting killed. Like, we gained nothing out of that.
Taylor and Jelks joined the CRED program together in February. They get anger management sessions, job training, and a salary, and they started taking online classes to get their high school diplomas. Today, 10 years after the murder of Taylor's cousin cemented their place in a gang, the two will be celebrating their high school graduation, along with 44 other members of Chicago CRED. Taylor and Jelks have become leaders in the program. The two men, hardened by navigating the worst of the violence in our city, called their mentoring program Understand We Love You. They are working with about 10 younger guys, all teenagers. They bring them to the Youth Peace Center in Roseland, try to give them a safe space and share advice.
Because CRED showed us, so now we're trying to get back to them to show them the same thing. So with them seeing us change and actually being from the same neighborhood, it's going to inspire them.
But in June, one of the kids from the group they'd started, 16-year-old Deshaun Reed, was murdered in his bed.
A teenager has been shot and killed on the city's far south side. Police say the 16-year-old boy was inside a home when he was shot in the head.
Deshaun's friends in the program are the same age now as Jelks and Taylor were when the murder of Taylor's cousin locked them into the cycle of violence. They knew the fear, anger, and confusion the kids were feeling, and the impulse to close ranks, push everything aside except survival and violence.
We were trying to prevent that from the start. And then just to let them know that we ain't, like, it's real, because y'all coming to the age where this one stuff started getting real. Because that's when it got real for us.
And they're trying to be a model for a different way of life.
And we trying to show them, like, we just not saying do something different. We're going to be doing different with you.
Taylor says today he expects he'll be thinking about his slain cousin as he accepts his diploma. Next, he plans to take college courses. He's thinking he might want to be a therapist. Patrick Smith, WBEZ News.
The last year was hard for students due to hybrid and remote learning brought on by the pandemic, but it was especially difficult for students who needed special education services. Eric Stock reports their parents hope a more normal year will help their children catch up.
Molly Emery of Bloomington has a young son, Aiden. He was set to start kindergarten at North Point Elementary last August. Emery says her son does well academically, but says he needs structure.
It's difficult for Aiden to regulate his feelings and his behaviors, whether that is excitement or whether it's sadness or anger. He's just a very intense kiddo.
Aiden was signed up for Unit 5's special education to get help with motor skills and speech. Aiden was nonverbal before he got speech therapy through Easter Seals. Because of the pandemic, Aiden started kindergarten, spending much of his time in front of a computer screen at home. It didn't go well, even with 4 days a week of hybrid instruction. The Emerys hoped remote learning would be short term, but COVID cases surged in McLean County last fall. By November, Unit 5 went all remote. Molly Emery says that's when it was time to get out.
I think that's when my husband and I like hit this wall of this can't go on. This is not sustainable. Our child is not sleeping. He's regressing. We're losing skills that took years to accomplish.
The Emerys were not alone, as pandemic restrictions forced educators to completely reimagine how they provide instruction. Molly Emery says children like Aiden fell through the cracks. In Unit 5, only the special ed students with more intensive needs got in-person learning for the full year. The district's director of special education is Carrie Chapman. Chapman says she wanted all special education students in person. That's nearly 2,200 district-wide. Chapman says she was told she could if there were enough teachers and other staff willing to work in person during the pandemic.
I could reach out to staff and ask them if they were willing to come in and do that. If I didn't have staff who were willing, then there wasn't any way for me to bring those students back.
Chapman says many staffers did come back, but others resisted, citing health concerns because of the pandemic. Chapman says some special ed students aren't able to wear a mask, and there was no COVID vaccine back then. So students in Level 1 special services, those who needed less support, stayed virtual or hybrid for a bulk of the school year. Chapman says she understands the difficulty some parents had watching their children struggle with online learning, but she says teachers did their best to build structure and flexibility into the curriculum. And she says in-person teaching doesn't always run as smoothly as they might imagine.
But what I had to remind staff and sometimes parents is that we see that in the classroom as well, where it's just not going to work for this student. And so we don't send them home, obviously. We work to build other supports in the classroom.
Despite the dramatically different format, leaders in special education in Bloomington Normal say students did much better in remote learning than you might think. Brandon Thornton teaches special ed, English, and math at Bloomington High School. Thornton says he saw a big increase in the number of kids who were on the verge of failing in the spring. He says remote learning caused anxiety for some students. He says it was especially hard for children who didn't have a true learning space at home, away from distraction. Thornton says teachers at BHS dropped curriculum that he says wasn't serving kids and drilled down on what was most relevant.
These are the most important scenes for English. These are the most important content for math that'll get them to the next level of math. And so we kind of cut out the things that didn't necessarily need to be done.
Thornton says that greater reinforcement of the most important content helps students recover and avoid learning loss. He says the modified format also revealed a truth for him about individual attention.
I think the power of assistance is way more important than what we as educators have believed. We were kind of forced to abandon homework. Some classes at least, and so we were doing a lot of the work in class.
But Thornton says he doesn't see teachers dropping homework anytime soon. Molly Emery's son, Aiden, dropped kindergarten for a time last year because she says remote learning wasn't helping. The Emerys enrolled him in a private preschool so he could be around other kids until Unit 5 brought all students back to the classroom. When that happened, Emery says, Aiden was like a different kid.
I'm almost going to cry. And you could ask his principal, you could ask his therapist, his teachers. Between February and May, it was phenomenal what he accomplished. It honestly kind of makes me, as happy as it makes you, it makes you sad to think of how much further he could be along.
As Aiden starts first grade, Molly Emery says she hopes he can move into general education by the time he gets out of grade school. Emery says she doesn't blame Unit 5 for the struggles Aiden faced last year, but she says she had to fight to get him legally mandated help. It amounted to 2 hours of in-person instruction and therapy each week.
I don't think history will be super friendly to the way that our special ed students were treated during this. They have rights that don't dissipate because of COVID, and those rights were definitely violated.
Emery says it worked out for Aiden because she was able to get him into a private preschool, but she says many other parents don't have that option. Emery says that's what keeps her up at night. I'm Eric Stock.
That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. Join us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. And don't forget, you can find our weekly podcast. Go to nprillinois.org, or you can use the NPR One app. We're also on Facebook. Just look for Statewide Show. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.